Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, who examines what led to the recent border skirmish between North and South Korea and how a dangerous escalation of hostilities can be prevented. Zainab Salvi, co-founder and president of Women for Women International, who discusses the discrimination and violence that women face, as well as their accomplishments in keeping society running in times of war. And award-winning investigative reporter Russ Baker, who discusses former President George W. Bush's new memoir, Decision Points, and his own new book about the Bush political dynasty titled Family of Secrets. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The most recent UN AIDS annual report finds that since the global AIDS crisis peaked in 1999, new HIV infections have fallen 19%, and growing access to anti-AIDS treatment has surged by nearly 20% since 2004. But still, over 10 million HIV-positive people are waiting to be treated with antiviral drugs. The progress report on the AIDS crisis comes at a time when international funding for AIDS care fell slightly. Dr. Aaron Ben-David of the Stanford University Medical School noted expanded treatment was possible because of the falling cost of AIDS drugs and wider use of generic medications. UNAIDS is calling for poor developing nations who have faced the brunt of the AIDS epidemic to take on more of the funding burden for AIDS care, since over 90% of the funding currently comes from international donors like the United States and Europe. The Global AIDS Report showcased the rapid fall in HIV infection rates in four hard-hit African countries: Ethiopia, South Africa, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. But in the countries of the former Soviet Union, HIV infection soared to 1.4 million new cases over the last decade, mostly in Russia and the Ukraine. In recent months, a widespread anti-immigrant backlash has shaken center-left and center-right coalition governments in Germany, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden. The new liberal-led coalition in the Netherlands must now rely on the political support of Geert Wilders, Europe's leading anti-Islamic basher. In Denmark, a liberal coalition now has an alliance with the anti-immigrant Danish People's Party. In the European Parliament, liberal party forces have tried unsuccessfully to promote an anti-extremist pact with both center-left and center-right parties. Former Danish Prime Minister Poul Rasmussen, a leader of the Party of European Socialists, told The Guardian newspaper, "I don't see a solution. The conservatives are saying if you can't beat them, join them." Left-leaning parties have recently lost clout to far-right anti-immigrant parties in Sweden, the Netherlands, and Austria. In France, there are growing calls for center-right President Nicolas Sarkozy to merge his coalition bloc with the far-right National Front run by Jean-Marie Le Pen. In Italy, where President Silvio Berlusconi rules in coalition with the far-right Northern League, the Interior Minister has ordered the expulsion of European Union citizens who cannot support themselves, a move aimed at removing the Roma, or Gypsy, minority. Mother Jones magazine reports right-wing Tea Party activists are now looking to halt smart growth initiatives in communities across suburban America, including plans to boost public transit to ease congested highways. Tea Party activists are using their clout in Republican circles to spread a conspiratorial view of the United Nations in local planning and zoning disputes. Their impact has been felt in decisions ranging from a septic tank inspection law in Florida to a plan to reduce traffic along Route 1 in coastal Maine. The focus of Tea Party fury is Agenda 21, the non-binding policy paper adopted by the 1991 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. The document sets broad outlines for sustainable development but has no enforcement power. For the Tea Party faithful, Agenda 21 is the genesis of all smart growth initiatives in suburban America and a direct attack on private property rights. Virginia Tea Party activist Donna Holt says Agenda 21 is a threat to the U.S. Constitution and the core values of suburban America, like the right to live in a single-family home. Holt is following the teachings of Henry Lamb, the founder of Sovereignty International, who for decades has theorized the UN covertly wants to herd millions of people into overcrowded cities and wall off the rest of the land into wildlife conservation areas. Thus far, Tea Party activists have succeeded in killing major initiatives to boost public transit and smart growth land use plans in some local communities across the United States. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
The November 23rd exchange of artillery fire between North and South Korea resulted in the deaths of two South Korean Marines and two civilians. It was part of a pattern of escalating violence between the two nations over the past year. In March, South Korea accused North Korea of torpedoing their Navy ship, the Cheonan, killing 46 sailors. While there's speculation that North Korea's shelling of the South's Yongpyong Island near the two nations' disputed maritime border was related to an expected transfer of power from Pyongyang's leader Kim Jong-il to his son Kim Jong-un, the conflict may have more to do with the South's military exercises in the region. The North accused South Korea of provoking the attack by firing into the disputed ocean region during the military training exercise, a charge that Seoul denies. Responding to the crisis, the U.S. and South Korea launched joint naval exercises in the Yellow Sea near the site of the recent artillery skirmish that included the American aircraft carrier USS George Washington. Meanwhile, North Korea's government announced that it is expanding its controversial nuclear program by building a new light water nuclear reactor and opening a plant to operate thousands of centrifuges to enrich uranium. Despite rising tensions, the U.S. and South Korea rejected a call by China to restart suspended six-party talks between North and South Korea, Japan, Russia, the U.S., and China. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, and author of the book North Korea, South Korea, the U.S. Policy in the Korean Peninsula. Pfeffer examines what led to the recent border skirmish between North and South Korea and how a dangerous escalation of hostilities can be prevented.
The maritime border between North and South Korea is disputed. The DMZ, which runs across the peninsula, generally speaking, is not disputed, but the maritime border is and has been since the end of the Korean War. And there have been any number of clashes that have taken place between North and South Korea, artillery exchanges, there have been naval clashes, clashes between fishing boats. More recently, South Korea has been holding military exercises on its side of the line, and last week it held live artillery exercise. It says that its artillery rounds did not pass over the northern limit line, the maritime boundary. North Korea disagreed. North Korea, of course, before these exercises had warned South Korea that it would retaliate if South Korea held these exercises so close to North Korean territory, but South Korea went ahead and did it anyway. In response, North Korea shelled Yongpyong Island. Yongpyong Island is one of the islands in this disputed area, and in fact, it's one of the islands that North Korea has in the past claimed as its own. Four South Koreans died as a result of the shelling. South Korea then retaliated by shelling North Korea. It's unknown whether any North Koreans died as a result of that. And that's more or less where we stand right now.
There's been some criticism of South Korea's conservative president, Lee Myung-bak, that his commitment to these military exercises despite warnings from the North and in the face of his rejection of previous policies of detente in the South towards the North may have contributed towards this exchange of artillery fire.
That's correct. basically the Imung Bak administration, when it came into office a couple years ago, promised to take a firmer stance toward North Korea after 10 years, basically, of an engagement policy by his two predecessors, Kim Dae-jung and Roh Moo-hyun. And as a result of that firmer posture toward the North, many of the initiatives that had begun 10 years before or over the past decade basically languished and essentially fell apart. Leading up to last March. Last March, the Chunnan, which is a South Korean ship, sank mysteriously, and there were about 47 South Korean sailors who died as a result of that. After doing extensive report on the nature of this sinking, South Korea concluded that it was North Korea that was behind the sinking, that it was a North Korean torpedo. There have been a lot of doubts and skepticism about this conclusion, but nevertheless, the South Korean government used that as an excuse to break off whatever remaining contacts there had been with the North. And so the relationship between North and South had deteriorated considerably since March. Essentially, the Lee Myung-bak administration had maintained its hardline position largely through a policy of isolation and kind of escalating military exercises, which it has held in conjunction with the United States.
Now, the United States and South Korea have announced joint military exercises near the disputed border region with a U.S. aircraft carrier and many other ships. Is this likely to ratchet up tensions, and is there a concern on your part about where this could lead? And what are the alternatives in your mind as opposed to these military exercises?
I fear that the current military exercises would indeed ratchet up tensions. North Korea certainly has said as much in its pronouncements. And as I said, this maritime border area is disputed and has been disputed in the past, has been the locus of any number of aggressive actions by both sides. To me, it would seem that holding provocative military exercises in this region, which from the U.S. and South Korean point of view is a show of strength, can easily be interpreted as provocative, not only by North Korea, but also by China, since this region, of course, is very close to China as well, an area which China, at one time or another, considers its part of its territorial waters. What is the alternative? Well, the alternative, frankly, is to sit down and talk with North Korea, preferably with China and Russia at the table as well. People might say, hey, we've tried to talk with North Korea in the past and nothing's happened. But in fact, our discussions with North Korea have produced results. They produced results in the 90s when the Clinton administration created negotiated the agreed framework in 1994, created results later at the end of the Clinton administration, and it created results when the Bush administration in 2006 changed its mind and decided to engage North Korea. All of those attempts produced real documents, produced real changes in North Korea, and I see no reason why a similar policy right now would have a similar effect.
That was John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. Read his articles online at fpif.org or his own website, johnpfeffer.com. Zainab Salbi grew up in Iraq and knows the effects of war firsthand. She co-founded Women for Women International in 1993 at the age of 23 to provide training for women living in conflict and post-conflict areas. The group offers women survivors of war, civil strife, and other conflicts with the tools and resources to move from crisis and poverty to stability and self-sufficiency, thereby promoting viable civil societies. Since its founding, Women for Women has raised $89 million for direct aid and microcredit loans to assist 270,000 women and 7 million family members. The group organizes a year-long aid program that provides rights education, job skills training, and small business development. Salbi is author of the book Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam, which tells the story of her life in Iraq and her flight to the U.S. where she now lives. Salby spoke on November 18th at Yale University, where she discussed the discrimination and violence that women face around the world, as well as their accomplishments in keeping society running in times of war. What follows is an excerpt from her talk.
If you look at any crisis in the world, and you will see women are at the heart or are disproportionately impacted by that crisis. 2/3 of the most impoverished population in the world are women. 80% of the refugees in the world are women and children. 90% of modern war casualties are civilians, 75% of which are women and children. Women are 70% of the farmers in the world. They are producing 60% of the food in the world. They are earning 10% of the income, and they own less than 2% of the land. If you want to look at the rates of HIV or illiteracy or whatever you want to look at it, whatever crisis in the world, you see women and girls are disproportionately impacted by the crisis. But when it comes to solutions, the solutions are, you see, women and girls are mostly on the marginal discussion. If you look at war as an example, we often discuss war from a frontline discussion. We often look at the army and the troops and the weapons and the military tactics and all of these things, and that's absolutely a very good way to look at war. This is one way of looking at war, and it's usually led by men. What we don't look, actually, is the backline discussion, which is how do you live in war? For some reason, and as someone who actually lived in war and now works in war, people forget, I'm surprised that people are always surprised to learn that people go to school in war and you have meals and you fall in love and you go to parties and go to weddings and get divorced and all the normal life happens within a war framework. But there is fighting, and in the TV you're only seeing the fighting. The backline discussion is usually led by women. They are literally keeping life going in the midst of war. Yet when we have peace agreements, it's usually about the frontline discussion. So it is about the ending of fighting as opposed to the building of peace, the backline discussion. And there is a way to include the two. We don't have to choose between women and men. There is a way to include the two, but no peace can be actually lasting and sustainable. And we were just talking earlier with someone here. Bosnia is a great example of a peace agreement that it was about the ending of fighting, not the building of peace, because you still actually have an instability in that country. So women in that way play a critical role. So rather than have women as a marginal discussion, you know, check all the ethnic minorities and gender minorities, check, we need to actually change it into the core of the discussion. There is no way we can talk about the building of sustainable societies, sustainable democracies, sustainable economies, if we are not including women at the heart of the discussion. And this is not because I lead Women for Women, or that I identify myself as a feminist or a strong woman, not at all. This is actually, at Women for Women, we argue there is no way we can have strong nations if we do not have strong women in it. So that the core of the discussion is how do you change it? And rather than seeing them on the margin, we have to see women at the core of the discussion, both at the decision-making as well as the solutions. A Sudanese woman once told me, I was in southern Sudan, and I was interviewing a woman, and I said, what does peace mean for you? And she looked down at her feet for a second, and she's thinking, and she's like, peace means I have toenails. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And she said, well, for the 20-plus years of war in southern Sudan, I was kidnapped twice by the rebels and enslaved by them, which meant that I had to carry water and ammunition and food, and I was raped by them throughout the period of my enslavement. So I stopped. Every time I escaped, I'm afraid of staying in one place for more than 5 nights. So I walked for the whole 18 years that she said. I walked and I did not sleep in one place more than 5 nights at a time. And I lost my toenails. And since there was a signing of a peace agreement, which is very fragile right now, she said, since the signing of a peace agreement, I stayed in one place and my toenails grew back again. So peace means I have toenails. Unless we look at peace from a toenails perspective, we are missing out on something really major. And how do you build sustainable peace?
That was Zainab Salby. co-founder and president of Women for Women International. Contact the group's Washington office by calling area code 202-737-7705 or visit their website at womenforwomen.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. In his new memoir titled Decision Points, former President George W. Bush provides his personal, upbeat account on the major events that shook the nation and his presidency. Among the episodes that Mr. Bush recounts are the initial confusion and critical decisions made after the devastating 9/11 attacks and the deliberations within his administration before he made the fateful decision to invade and occupy Iraq. Reaction to the book included the half-serious notion that decision points should be correctly placed in the true crime section of local bookshops, citing Mr. Bush's authorization of mass arrests, detention without charge or trial, torture of prisoners, and warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens. Violations of international law that were perpetrated by Mr. Bush during his 8 years in office prompted London Mayor Boris Johnson to warn that if the former president flew to Britain on a book tour, he might well be arrested for war crimes, much like Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet was in 1998. Critics point out that there are many passages in Decision Points written with the help of Peter Ruff and his former speechwriter Christopher Michel that appear to be lifted wholesale from articles and books found in a quick search of the internet. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Russ Baker, award-winning investigative reporter and author of the new book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Here, Baker discusses Mr. Bush's memoir, Decision Points, and what his own book reveals about the Bush family's powerful political dynasty.
Essentially, what I discovered with George W. Bush, like his father, had a secret life, that he has been sorely underestimated, that he was really like a partner to his father and was in a minor way kind of privy to and being trained in the family business, which was all of these covert operations on behalf of wealthy families, what you might call the American aristocracy. So I found all kinds of foreign travels and companies of George W. Bush that have never been reported before. I also found that many of these stories, like why he invaded Iraq, that there was another story. So for example, I interviewed a man who worked with George W. Bush in 1999 when he was merely a candidate for the GOP nomination for the presidency, who had never spoken to the public before about what they talked about. He talked to me, and he told me how when he was discussing with Bush what he would do as president, Bush actually told him that if elected president, he intended to invade Iraq. That was way before 9/11, so this is quite significant admission. And when Bush told him that, he was sort of surprised, and he said, "What's your thinking on that?" And the reason was even more surprising. Bush told him, he said, that he realized that you could not have a successful presidency, simply put, if you did not have a war. That you needed to be seen not as the president, because presidents are seen as one of the lowest forms of life in the sense of being a politician, but that the commander-in-chief, the other half of that split personality, was something that people would revere. And he realized that if you had a war, if it was manageable, your ratings would go right to the roof. And of course, after 9/11, his ratings did go through the roof. They dropped somewhat, and then with the Iraq invasion, they again went through the roof. And so he was right up to a point, but he rather significantly miscalculated because he did think that it was going to be a cakewalk.
Well, Russ, the other features of the Bush presidency are post 9/11, when he ordered massive roundup of Arabic men of a certain age, committed torture, opened up Guantanamo Bay. A lot of covert operations were launched post 9/11. What are some of the things that you've uncovered in the Bush presidency that our listeners really need to know about?
Well, one thing is that we FEMA, a very interesting Federal Emergency Management Agency, most people think of it as an agency that's supposed to help people. But when it was originally conceived, it was essentially about handling situations in an emergency. And so while helping people out in a flood may be one side of it, the other side of it is what do you do when you have a situation where you need to control the population itself. And so these things like funding of these private companies to build these camps, which they have built, which are for the purpose of potentially holding, they say, large numbers of illegal aliens in the case of an emergency. FEMA, there's a whole other story there. There's a thing called continuity of government, where they created a kind of a shadow government in absentia. When Clinton was in power, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and so on were sort of wargaming out a kind of a parallel government. There are a lot of dangerous things going on that have never been fully explored or understood. I begin to get into them in Family of Secrets, and I hope that it's just the beginning of further research.
Former President George W. Bush, his new book, Decision Points, make a lot of declarations about why he undertook the policies he did during his presidency. With all your research, what have you found that directly contradicts President Bush's assertions there in that book?
Well, you know, what he does is anything really important, he goes very quickly over. So he mentions his National Guard service very, very briefly. And it's interesting to me, and I intend to write some things on this, probably on our nonprofit website, whowhatwhy.com. But he, for example, he tells some stories in here that are actually different than he's told some years ago. I see that no one has fact-checked any of this and even seen these anomalies. But so, for example, with the National Guard service, he just touches on it very, very briefly, and he says, well, you know, they say that I didn't serve, but I remember being there, and then he refers to some sort of you know, deceptive stories that they put out that supposedly verified that he was there. He does it very half-heartedly. He doesn't try to get in there and passionately say, I really remember serving and here's what I did. On a lot of other things, you know, throughout the book, he always talks about his faith. You see, what this book is this book is not a memoir. This book was a very carefully constructed attempt to bring about and to lead the way for the resurgence of the Bush interests back to the top again. They're going to use this. They're solidifying the base. They're reassuring their base voters. That's why they have the faith stuff in there, because they're appealing to the evangelical Christians who formed a crucial part of their victory in 2000 and 2004. Without them, they clearly would have lost overwhelmingly. They need to play to those people. The story about the fetus in the jar, I believe, is playing to their pro-life constituency. Much of the other stuff is appealing to veterans and so on. It's a calculation, not an authentic memoir by any stretch of the imagination.
That was Russ Baker, award-winning investigative reporter and author of the new book, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Learn more about the book at his website, familyofsecrets.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.